Good morning. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. I've never been to the Fields Institute before or the University of Toronto. So this is a nice experience for me. So thank you again. I am going to talk about everything from sea cucumbers to gray seals and quite a sort of a diverse repertoire of statistics to cover that, which are computationally intensive, at least in one sense or another. So I'm going to start with a plug. This is truly my belief that statistics is driven by practical application. And so what I'm going to attempt to do this morning is show you three such examples of that, three projects. The pictures we'll see again later. The first project deals with fish population dynamics, which has and probably always will be a very hot topic on the East Coast where I'm from. We have cod stocks, which have never sort of come back or vitalized following being overfished what was now a long time ago. I'm also going to talk about trends in invertebrate fisheries because we've done such a poor job of managing finfish. What's happened is we now are tending to overfish invertebrates. So those are things like lobster, which we have lots of at home, crabs, sea urchins, sea cucumbers. And then finally, I will talk a little bit about the Ocean Tracking Network, which is headquartered at Dalhousie. So first, a little background. All of these projects relate to marine ecology. So what, in fact, is marine ecology? Well, it's concerned with organisms that live in or near the ocean, their behaviors, and their interactions with the environment. And so, of course, with climate change being a big issue, we certainly need to think about the ramifications to marine ecology, which is where a lot of the problems are going today. So the first thing to do here is to pose some scientific questions. The three questions that I'm going to consider and have been considering with my collaborators is, first of all, can we understand the processes affecting the abundance of fish populations? The second one is, are invertebrate species being increasingly exploited globally? And the third one, are gray seals responsible for depleted Atlantic cod stocks on the eastern Scotian shelf? Very recently, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Canada, had a press release suggesting that they were thinking seriously about killing one-third of the seals on Sable Island, which is a tiny little island off the coast of Nova Scotia. So one-third of 300,000 seals is a lot of seals. And the idea there is that the seals eat the cod, and if we kill the seals, then the cod will come back. Scientifically, the whole idea of that is far less clear, and in fact there's a lot of science to suggest that the seals have little to do with what's actually happened, and doing that is not going to work. So some of the work that I'll show this morning relates at least indirectly to that particular question. So to answer those scientific questions, we need scientific answers. In marine ecology, those answers are typically going to rely on experiments, field surveys, and statistical modeling, which is, of course, where people like us can get involved. These answers are computer intensive, in keeping with today's theme, with respect to one or both of the following. The amount of data, there's been an explosive increase even in the last 5 years in the amount of data that's collected on fish populations and various other things, even sort of the biophysical properties of the ocean. And so there's this enormous amount of data that we need to dig through in order to figure out what's required to try and answer some of these questions. The other thing that's quite computer intensive, at least at times, is the methodologies. And so I'll try and give some examples of that as well. So the first project deals with Atlantic cod. This is a picture of one. The central idea is to try and understand the fish population dynamics. The data is a comprehensive database of stock assessments. So these are assessments done by managers to determine essentially the productivity of the stock. In all three projects, in all three situations, what I'll show you in this sort of greeny color is just the website where you can access this sort of data. And we'll talk more about this particular website in a moment. So a little bit of background. It's a bit wordy, this slide, but I think it's important. A stock is really a subpopulation of a particular species. They really have a management connotation. for which intrinsic parameters like growth, recruitment, which we're going to look at in detail today, mortality and fishing mortality are the only significant factors in determining the population dynamics. Extrinsic factors like immigration and emigration are considered to be insignificant. Recruitment is what I'm particularly interested in at the moment. This is the process whereby new fish enter the portion of the population vulnerable to fishing from earlier life history stages. It's also a term that's used essentially for the number of recruits in a given year. Why is recruitment important? Well, it all basically goes back to this fellow Ricker in 1954, who showed and believed that that fish populations could be regulated by virtue of their abundance at an early age, so really by recruitment. And so the deterministic model that we're going to embed in our statistical models is really a result of Ricker. So this is the database. By way of an aside, I actually ended up working in marine ecology as a result of the fact I did a postdoc in Switzerland and I came back to Halifax, which is where all my family is and my husband and various other important people, and I had about 6 months before my position at Dow started, and that was because I was hired under the environmental statistics umbrella, and so the funding was ready for July 1st, and I was back there in November of the year prior. So I went to work as a research associate in a marine ecology lab. It was really a fisheries type lab run by Ransom Myers, so that's where we get the RAM here. He was a world-renowned fisheries biologist who did a huge amount of work in trying to protect fish stocks, particularly cod. We actually, unfortunately, lost him to cancer during the few months I was there. And as a result, I ended up working a great deal more than originally planned with a lot of his students, many of whom were very quantitative and left in the lab. And so two of the projects I'll talk about today stem directly from that effort in 2007-2008. So this is really, in my mind, a methodological testbed for novel statistical methods. This is a huge database. It's large in scope. This picture is just meant to show you that we have stocks globally. And for instance, this pale green says there's 5 to 9 stocks here, and you can see it varies depending on where you are. There's approximately 640 stocks, and there's records going back to the early 1900s. There's even a few back to 1890. Okay, so it's large, and the students really took this on and developed this in his honor, and it's been used and will continue to be used and maintained. So back to Ricker. This is really the traditional approach to recruitment. So RT here is the abundance of fish of a given age. At time t, tau is their actual age. Alpha is the slope at the origin of the relationship, which is what we're interested in. S, t minus tau is basically the spawners that produce these recruits. And beta is the density-dependent mortality rate. Cods, in some parts of their life cycle, are actually cannibals, so the number of cod actually matters. And so that's why we have this term. And this is really the form regularly fit to recruitment data for the purpose of forecasting recruitment in coming years. So fisheries scientists use this form and variants of it quite often. What we were interested in is this maximum reproductive rate. So this is a nice area to work in for statisticians because there's a parameter, alpha, which is of central importance to the ecologists. And it's centrally important to population ecology and resource management. It essentially represents the maximum number of recruits produced per spawner at low density, so when we don't have to worry about density-dependent mortality. And it determines, among other things, the intrinsic rate of population growth, productivity, and overfishing limits. I'm going to, for the purposes of keeping things simple, just use productivity and alpha interchangeably. Okay? So our motivation was that it really doesn't seem likely that there isn't any interannual variation in alpha. And so what we wanted to do was allow for some stochastic variation in alpha, which would give us the opportunity to track changes in productivity. Why was this important? Well, if you read the fisheries literature, and I certainly haven't read it all, but my collaborators certainly have, there's this huge array of hypothesized drivers of productivity. So things like the physical environment, the temperature of the water, whether how salty it is, so the salinity, biological environment, things like species interactions, and even life history characteristics. So there's all these hypotheses, some are competing, and really nobody knows exactly which ones are most important. So what we decided to do was almost take a step back and first of all do a really good job of explaining, well, how has productivity changed? Rather than why has it changed, let's first figure out how it looks like it's changed. And so that was the particular question that we were interested in with these models. So again, this is the traditional equation again in the traditional approach. And you can see here we have alpha that is not indexed by time. If we decide we're going to allow it to vary with year, then we get something which looks like this. And so it's going to have different slopes and different years, essentially. To fit this, we took a state-space model approach. So we linearized the model. Linear Gaussian state-space models are really easy to fit. Non-linear, non-Gaussian state-space models are more difficult. That's where you need things like particle filters and MCMC, that sort of thing. So as a first step, we did it the easy way, and now we're involved in far more computationally intensive problems around looking at different models for the recruitment, et cetera. So for the moment, we have this linearized Ricker model. We have a random walk on AT, so AT is just the lawn of the maximum reproductive rate. We formulated as a state-space model where we have a measurement equation and a transition equation, and these are the actual details which aren't, I guess, that important, but keep in mind that we have this two-part model, which is one of the great benefits of state-space modeling, and we can then fit it and see how this parameter is varying through time. So state and parameter estimation are done for linear Gaussian state-space models very easily using the Kalman filter and smoother. Again, if we consider alternative formulations for AT and the Ricker relationship, then we can move quickly into a more complex setting. In this nice, simple situation, we can use AIC to compare models. We can also think about multi-stock formulations where we would have a separate measurement error variance for each stock, and as well as a covariance matrix, which would tell us sort of how stocks relate to each other that are in some region of interest. So as an application, we considered 10 Northeast Atlantic cod stocks. We've actually done this for others, but I chose this one, and then I looked at this last night in my hotel room and thought, this is way too busy, but I couldn't figure out a way to change it late last night. So bear with me. The first and the third columns are the tracks of the reproductive rate parameter. Okay, through time. So our AIC in some cases suggests that it should be constant, our model selection. In other cases, it varies. What's important to note here is in a lot of cases, we see that it's getting smaller and smaller, which is alarming, obviously, for fisheries. The fact that some of these are more jagged than others is just a feature of state-space models. The more data, the more you see that. In the second and fourth rows, we see recruitment. So you can see the recruitment part of the model. So all of these, so each pair of two plots, so the reproductive rate and the recruitment, were fit individually. So this was a uni-stock formulation, and that's why I decided this was the wrong slide. But so sorry about that. So each one of these is done for one of 10 stocks. What we then did is decided, well, we'd like to analyze them simultaneously. So now we have a multi-stock formulation where now we're just looking at the reproductive rates for ease of illustration. The yellow is from the univariate fix or the individual stock modeling, and then the blue is from the multivariate fit. So one of the nice things about the state space model is with the smoothing you can kind of do a hind cast. So we expect these confidence bounds to be wide, and they are. So we're now just looking and trying to understand exactly what we can tease out of formulations like this one, and if it makes sense to group some stocks in the Northeast Atlantic together and analyze them together, etc. Okay, so in summary, what we can see definitively is productivity has varied markedly over the time period investigated, which we sort of knew intuitively, but it's certainly nice to quantify. Many stocks are currently at historically low productivity. So this is a real headache for fisheries people, but a fact of life, at least on the East Coast at the moment. Trends appear largely to be conserved across regions, and looking at some of the covariance structures from those multi-stock models, we can see that. And basically, the space-based model formulation with the Ricker relationship embedded or any other recruitment type relationship provide a useful framework that integrates across many dimensions of environmental change affecting recruitment dynamics. So the PhD student that I've been working with on this is just he's defending his thesis in May and writing this workup. So now on to the second project. These are sea cucumbers. They're dried sea cucumbers. This is a picture taken in Vancouver a couple of years ago. They were $438 a pound. And if you go back to the same store last week, they were $888 a pound. So these are immensely valuable. On the East Coast, we're used to talking about lobsters being expensive, which is now about $5 a pound, to give you some context. So sea cucumbers are one example of an invertebrate. So an invertebrate is an animal without a backbone. Here we're interested in invertebrates that live in the ocean, like lobster, scallops, crab, sea urchins, sea cucumbers. The central idea is to do a global evaluation of the trends, drivers, and population and ecosystem consequences of invertebrate fisheries. In my experience with marine ecologists, those that I collaborate with, this sort of global assessment is really the type of work that they wish to do. And so what they want to do is look at invertebrates globally. What I'm going to do, just to simplify things a bit, is we'll look at sea cucumbers in particular. But keep in mind, we've sort of done this for a variety of invertebrates. The data all comes from what's referred to as the Sea Around Us Project's Global Catch Database, which is right here, as well as some taxa-specific reviews. The methods are, in some sense, at least straightforward, GLMs, GAMs, etc., but again, applied on a fairly large scale. So this is just meant to show you the dark blue areas are where we really fish. So these are catches across the globe. And you can see that invertebrates are being fished everywhere. On my left, so your right, the solid red line is the invertebrate catch in millions of tons from 1950 until about 2006. The dashed line is total catch, so that's in 10 to the 7 rather than 10 to the 6. So in magnitude, it's bigger. So this includes finfish and other things that we've been fishing, as well as the invertebrates. So it tends to be increasing at a slower rate. And then the blue line is just the mean invertebrate catches by country. So the main message here is that we're fishing more and more invertebrates and relatively less finfish. So we're going to focus in particular on sea cucumbers. So this is one on the ocean floor. It's an increasingly harvested group. It occurs in most benthic, so that's sort of low in the water column, marine habitats worldwide. They help maintain a healthy ocean because they filter the water. They're of great social and economic importance. I'm told that in Asia, these are dried sea cucumbers are seen as a delicacy and good luck at weddings. And they're highly valuable, as I've already mentioned. So why was it difficult to determine the global status of sea cucumbers? Well, generally, there's a lack of abundance data. Nobody really goes out and counts cucumbers, sea cucumbers, so we have to rely on catch data. Import and export statistics tend to be incomplete. And the trade of sea cucumbers is inherently complex. So we have to make the best of the data that we have. So the goals really were to synthesize the current status of trends of sea cucumbers worldwide, look for general patterns, whether it was increase or decrease, and then analyze the underlying drivers of that pattern. I think this is a really neat project from a statistical point of view. Some of the work that I've done in marine ecology, I found that particularly in ornithology or with birds, people seem fixated on talking about trends as slopes as straight lines. So this is really the first time that I've been involved in using a GAM and looking at a sort of a smooth pattern and having success in the literature and in getting it published. It was actually the sea cucumber stuff was picked up very quickly by science and the invertebrate fisheries stuff as well. So we didn't actually send it there for publication, but then they came and wanted to hear more about it, which was kind of interesting. So the fact that we have this sort of pattern rather than a trend, and people understand it and appreciate it, was quite nice from a statistical point of view, at least. So understand, in an ideal fisheries management scenario, a fishery would develop as a gradual increase towards a plateau near a sustainable yield. So it would kind of flatten off, and we'd take as much out, we'd sort of fish it sustainably. And what's happened with sea cucumbers is not that. So in order to figure out what was happening generally, we standardized the catch. We then lagged the catches so each country's catch reached a maximum or reached that plateau, if you will, in the same year. The peak years were essentially identified from a low S curve. There were a few exclusions. So, for example, on the east coast of Canada, they've just started fishing sea cucumbers, and so the fishery's rapidly expanding. It hasn't reached a plateau or started to decrease yet. And we used GAMS. So the model, which is commonly used in fishery science, is to take the standardized catch, assume that they have a gamma distribution, and then we have a parametric term here for country, and then this smooth function of year relative to peak year, and that's exactly what we're interested in particular. I would just mention here, we decided not to do a mixed version of this because really we have now all the countries fishing sea cucumbers. It's across the globe, and so in a sense the problem was complete. It didn't seem sensible to look at these countries as a sample of something for which we had all the information. So the fixed effect seemed more reasonable. We also assumed that the errors had some structure, so they followed an autoregressive form. This is just meant to show you that there's about 26 countries that were fishing sea cucumbers, and all I've done here is kind of superimpose the results of the GAM, which is best summarized by looking at the global trajectory. So essentially, this is a boom and bust pattern. That's what the data tells us, is that what we're doing is we're going and we're fishing the sea cucumbers till we can't fish them anymore, and we'll see in a moment we then move on to another fishery, usually another country. So what are the drivers of that relationship? Well, it turns out that most sea cucumbers are flown directly to Hong Kong, and then they're consumed in Hong Kong and China. So what we did is we used the Great Circle Distance from Hong Kong on the y-axis, that's shown here, and then on the x-axis is the year that the recent fishery began. We set a GLM, and you can really see that basically what was happening is the sea cucumbers were totally exploited close to Hong Kong, and then we move away and fish them, move further away, and we're willing to do that, which is why the price goes up, because then they have to go all the way back to Hong Kong. So you can see our Canadian East Coast fisheries way up here. It's just begun. On the second plot, so on your right, the time to peak is on the y-axis, and the year that the fishery began is on the x. And what's alarming here is that what's happening is as we move away from Hong Kong, we're actually, these fisheries are developing faster and faster. And the reason that is there's no management, because management has not caught on to this as quickly as one would have liked, and that's partially because it's been a while to figure out exactly what's going on. So the same thing actually happened years ago for finfish fisheries, and now we're seeing exactly the same thing happening for invertebrate fisheries. So the whole point of this work was to try and get management on board to stop some of this from happening. There are places, so in Alaska, they kind of rotate the fisheries every 3 years. So there are places where it's being done sustainably, but that's certainly not the norm, as you've just seen. So in summary, in only a few decades, most sea cucumber fisheries around the world have experienced a boom and bust pattern, and we were able to show that. Over time, this happened faster and further away from the main market in Hong Kong and China. And unfortunately, about 80% of sea cucumber fisheries have experienced population decline, which is, of course, not what we would like. So more generally, keep in mind that this was done for sea cucumbers. It was also done for other types of invertebrates. New methodologies to quantify spatial and temporal trends, like I've presented, or at least some of, are useful for identifying the sort of, or resource status and fishery development. Since 1950, global invertebrate catches have increased sixfold. So this is a huge fishery. And new fisheries have developed increasingly rapidly to keep up with the demand. Okay, this is the third project. This isn't a great figure. I probably blew it up too big. But basically, this is a baby gray seal on Sable Island. The Ocean Tracking Network is a $170 million conservation project that's headquartered at Dalhousie. So this is really big for the East Coast. It's big for Dalhousie. And essentially, what it's meant to do is to really do a census of the oceans, or a comprehensive examination of marine life and ocean conditions with emphasis on understanding how they are changing as the Earth warms. It's called the Ocean Tracking Network because what's been done is they've put these sort of acoustic listening lines all over the globe. So some have been installed, some are still being installed. And the idea is if we tag things in the ocean when they swim by the lines, we're going to know what's where. The project that I'm involved in is slightly different from that, but we'll see the details of it in a moment. So essentially, for this to work, we have a global network of biologists, computer scientists, oceanographers, and statisticians. I would add, I don't think there's enough statisticians yet, so keep that in mind. this is the website where you can go to read all about it. It's really just starting. There's talk of a sort of a Halifax Marine Institute, so this is all happening at the moment. The central idea of the work that I'm involved in has to do with the design principles. What we want to do is estimate distribution of encounters, so I'm going to tell you what an encounter is in a moment. In some sense, this is a brand new data type, which is kind of exciting for people like us. The methods we've taken, at least preliminarily, are spatial point process analyses. So in order to properly define encounter, I need to tell you what a bioprobe is. So a bioprobe is an animal like this one, instrumented with a tag. So this gray seal actually has two tags. It has a satellite tag on its head, which tells us where he is with some amount of error because it's an Argos satellite tag. So when they're tagged again this coming January, they'll have GPS tags, so they'll be better. And then it's got a business card tag on its back. So this is what's new. And this business card tag basically tells us when this seal comes within about 500 meters of another acoustically tagged animal. So the whole idea here was to go back to this cod seal issue and see if the seals were hanging out with the cod, perhaps eating them. And so every time this particular gray seal would encounter a cod that had been tagged, we would get what we call an encounter. And so when this seal hauls out on Sable Island, these tags are taken off and uploaded, and we then get this encounter data set. So you can see it would be nice to do all this online, but for the moment, this is as good as it gets. And so that's a bioprobe. The particular application that I'm involved in right now is to have these gray seals as bioprobes. They're nice because they always come back to the same place so we can get the tags back. Atlantic cod and other fish will have acoustic transmitters embedded, but what happened last year is they tagged the wrong cod. So they tagged the wrong cod stock, and the gray seals didn't come anywhere near the cod that had tags. So in the meantime, and this is another nice opportunity for statisticians, we're actually waiting in some sense for the real data. And so for now, what actually turned out to be interesting, but nobody really thought about it before, is we actually have the encounters of the seals with each other. So there were 14 bioprobes, if you will, and we have the information telling us when they saw each other. And really, as soon as these seals leave Sable Island, we have no idea how they behave. So that data was useful in and of itself. The other thing we've done is thought about, well, we're in the process of simulating data so that when we tag the right cod and get this information, we're really in a position to analyze it properly, or we'll at least have teased out some of the possible problems. So these are the satellite tracks for the 14 bioprobes that were released the first year. And you can see this is over a three-month period, so it's not obvious, but it does look sensible to imagine that seals encountered each other at least some point in space. Now, if we download the bioprobes, as we did, we get these encounters. So the different colors represent different seals. And what's interesting from a behavior ecology point of view is that they tend to cluster, these encounters cluster on the banks. So the banks are the shallow parts of the Scotian shelf where it's presumed that seals are feeding. So as a start, and I'm not suggesting for one moment that this is how we're going to analyze all the bioprobe data that we get from the Ocean Tracking Network, but this was a way for us to at least tease out some of what was going on. So to do a spatial point process analysis, and this was fairly new to me, you have to define a spatial window, which is the space on which the process occurs. This is not only the geographic area of interest, but it also functions as part of the model in a sense. You then start describing the intensity, which is the expected number of points per unit area. If it's constant, then really you have a homogeneous Poisson process by definition. Otherwise, if it changes over the window, you have an inhomogeneous Poisson process. The next step is really to think about the interaction or the dependence between points. Here we use pairwise distance methods for which there are many. This led us to you can then think about whether your data is clustered or not, and it may actually lead to a definition of parents and offspring. So you could have a sort of a collection of parents, and around each of the parents or clusters, if you will, is a collection of points. So when we did this for the seal-to-seal encounters, for those of you who know about spatial point process, some of the details where we used the method of Ripley and Rassen to estimate the spatial window, we then determined that we were really dealing with a Maturin cluster process where we have the initial encounters between any two seals as the parents, which follow an inhomogeneous Poisson process across the window. And then each encounter has a Poisson number of offspring. And some of the parameters to describe those processes, we actually had to estimate from the data. So when we actually looked at the data and then a realization, we were doing pretty well. Now, we expected to do well in some sense, but this really validated that we had the right form of the model. So moving forward, this is work that's just beginning. It looks like we're in the right ballpark when it comes to describing the process. From a behavior point of view, it's really interesting because it doesn't look like they're traveling in pairs or groups, which nobody knew much about before. What we'd like to do next is to allow the intensity of the process to depend on the bathymetry or anything else. So the bathymetry is simply the depth, and it looks like they tend to prefer banks, so we could inform the model independently of the data there and see what we got out. Of course, the whole goal of this from an OTN perspective is to look at seal cod encounters. There's also a lot of work out there to suggest that it may be mackerel that are actually causing the problem, because mackerel tend to eat the egg, so it may not be the cod at all. So really you need to tag more than just cod, but you can see that you have to start somewhere. And then we could start to ask questions like, does the cod distribution influence the seal distribution? Now, from a statistical point of view, this isn't trivial, because you can think that we can't tag the cods randomly. We have to tag them in a boat and pick, say, usually it's on the order of 100 cods, so we pick them out of the ocean, tag them. We don't actually know what happens when we drop them back in, if half of them die, etc. You can't tag the seals randomly. You just have to tag them when they're on sable. And so there's a lot of things that make this a little more complicated than we're used to. So what's been obvious to me in doing some of the preliminary work is there's a lot more work that needs to be done in even understanding how the tags work. And that really has to be done in conjunction with the engineers. I mean, it looks from the data like seals don't move together, but it could be that the flow noise, so the fact that they're moving at some speed, could disallow an encounter being recorded by the business card tag. We don't even know that for sure. So we need to do a lot more exploratory work to make sure that we're getting the type of data we think we're getting. There's a lot of discussion with oceanography to try and explore the role of biophysical processes. That may not even be so much about the behavior of the animals, but even in the performance of the tags, at least initially. This whole technology and methodology, the plan is to export it across the globe, so to have bioprobes everywhere, because you can imagine, if you think about the west coast of Canada, as soon as salmon go into the open ocean, nobody really knows what they do. And so if you could have some form of bioprobe there, you could learn a lot if you had the problem set up right. So this type of technology could really go far if we figure out how to do it properly. The other thing I wanted to say is I think, and hopefully we'll talk about this a bit more this afternoon, that visualization tools, now that we have this huge propensity of data, it would be nice to really have tools to visualize it before we even think about analysis, because I think a lot can be learned there. So that's another sort of area that I'm really interested in and haven't done much with yet. So the general message is, I'd like to leave you with is that data and methodology drive science. Data sets are expanding very, very rapidly, at least in marine ecology, and yet getting it and organizing it is a momentous task. And this is a task that, at least in much of the work that I've been involved in, it's been left to sort of biology students. To do any of this work, it seems like somebody has to spend a couple years getting, whether it's the Sea Around Us database or the stock recruitment database, sort of up and running. And so I don't think enough credit's given there. I think we need to really value that type of work because it's essential that it be done properly in order to move anything else along. The third message I think is also important. Here I say active collaboration is essential. When I was trained, which wasn't that long ago, I guess I had it in my mind, and perhaps this was false, but I always had this vision of people coming to my office and giving me a data set and I was supposed to analyze it and hand it back to them. And at least in marine ecology, that no longer happens. The collaboration between statisticians and marine ecologists really is dynamic, and it happens as part of the data collection process. It happens when you're trying to write down the scientific questions, and then again, it happens when you're trying to analyze the results, interpret the results. So it's really an active collaboration, which is really fun and interesting, and you certainly learn a lot. Work like this really tests our statistical methodology. It can lead to enhancements or improvements or redevelopments. So I really think it's essential. And finally, and probably most importantly, it's challenging. I didn't have a strong biology background. I was too busy computing things. And so it's really been nice, somewhat daunting at times, to learn more about this field. And it's also extremely exciting. The marine ecologists I work with, the messages that they're giving are picked up around the world, and they're really important in understanding things like climate change. So I would certainly recommend it for any of you interested in working in applied statistics. So thank you very much for your attention. Just a few acknowledgments. Coylin Minto was the PhD student involved in the fish population dynamics problem. He's just taken a biostatistician job in Ireland. Boris Worm was the marine ecologist I was working with on that project. Sean Anderson was a master student involved in the invertebrate work. He's now gone out to do a degree, a PhD in quantitative ecology on the West Coast. And Heike Lutz was the marine ecologist involved there. Stuart Carson is my master's student in the Department of Division of Statistics. He's the one working on the bioprobe data. Ian Johnson and Greg Breeder are collaborators within OTN. And then finally, Chris Field is retired, but he was a professor at Dalhousie, and he agreed to come in and listen to me practice this last week. In terms of funding agencies, I must, of course, thank Dalhousie University, the Ocean Tracking Network, which in some sense has too much money. It seems like people are just tagging things without much thought at why. And then finally, NSERC. So thank you.